This is the Electronic Intifada Newscast. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman, Associate Editor at the Electronic Intifada. It's day 902 of Israel's genocide in Gaza. Here's a brief summary of some of the latest developments this week in Palestine. At least one Palestinian was killed and seven others were wounded on Wednesday when an Israeli airstrike targeted tent shelters in the Amira camp in Deir al-Balah in central Gaza. The local Wafa news agency said that 22-year-old Abdurrahman Kanbur was killed. Reporter Ashraf Amra caught the airstrike on video. A child was shot dead by Israeli forces while he was inside his tent shelter in Al-Mawasi, southern Gaza, on Tuesday. The child was identified as 13-year-old Khalid Saif al-Din Arada. Three other Palestinians, including a 17-year-old girl, were injured by Israeli gunfire in tent encampments along the southern coast in Al-Mawasi, and three others were shot and wounded in the Fallujah area of Jabalia in northern Gaza. Another Palestinian was injured in the Burej refugee camp in the central Gaza Strip, Wafa reported. Israel targeted a police vehicle in the Nuseirat refugee camp on Sunday, March 22nd, killing three police officers and personnel. Several others were wounded in the attack. Exactly a week before, an Israeli missile struck a police car in the nearby town of Zueida, killing eight police officers. Earlier in the day, on Sunday, March 22nd, a separate strike in the Sheikh Radwan neighborhood of northern Gaza killed a senior figure from an armed group, Al Jazeera reported. The Palestinian Health Ministry in Gaza stated that 690 Palestinians have been killed and more than 1,800 have been wounded since the so-called ceasefire, which began in October. Over the weekend, it was reported that a toddler, 21-month-old Jawad Abu Nasser, was subjected to apparent torture by Israeli soldiers who detained him and his father, Osama, last week in central Gaza. Maha Husseini, a journalist and researcher with Euromed Human Rights Monitor, spoke to the family and to medical officials after the story broke. According to the family, Husseini writes in Middle East Eye, Osama had taken his son out at around 10 a.m. to buy sweets ahead of the Eid holiday. Osama, who had been grappling with severe trauma after losing his home, his unborn child, and his livelihood during the war, never returned, Husseini reported. Osama's father told Husseini that neighbors saw Osama carrying his child and was walking toward the so-called yellow line, in the wrong direction that he was supposed to be heading. Israeli soldiers stationed on the other side of the invisible yellow line fired shots around him, the father said. And shortly afterwards, an Israeli quadcopter drone approached Osama and ordered him to remove his clothes. After learning his son had been detained, Mohammed, the father, went to Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital in Deir al-Balah and left his phone number, asking to be contacted if his son and grandson were brought in, Maha Husseini reported. 10 hours later, the staff with the International Committee of the Red Cross called him and told him that they had his grandson. A video recorded by the Israelis of the handover of the toddler was released by the military. Little Jawad was wrapped in a silver emergency blanket and given to the Red Cross staff member. Maha Husseini writes that, quote, when the child was brought home, the family tried to ask him what had happened, but he could only say, ma'am, a broken pronunciation of the Arabic word dem, meaning blood. We asked him who caused this blood. He could not answer. When we asked, where is your father? He said only, gone. That was all he could say. But when his mother hugged him, he screamed and cried, Mohammed said. She removed his clothes and found wounds on his body. There were burns around and behind his knees, as well as another wound caused by a nail or sharp object, with both an entry and an exit wound. The child spent the night awake and crying. The following morning, his family took him to the hospital. It was the first day of Eid, but it wasn't Eid for us, Mohammed said. We took him to the hospital where two doctors confirmed the injuries were not caused by shrapnel or other ammunition, but were consistent with signs of torture and cigarette burns. Middle East Eye reviewed photos of the child's injuries taken shortly after he was admitted to the hospital, showing a deep wound to his calf consistent with a sharp object, with both entry and exit points, as well as marks consistent with cigarette burns. Medical reports reviewed by the publication, quote, confirmed the child had knee swelling and wounds around both knees, mostly due to cigarette marks. Husseini writes that Mohammed believes the Israeli soldiers may have misunderstood Osama's psychological state and attempted to force a confession from him by harming his toddler. When this yielded no result, Mohammed said they released the boy. Footage by Al Jazeera's Tariq Abu Azoum showed copies of the medical reports which indicated signs of physical abuse of the toddler. In a testimony gathered by the Palestinian human rights group Al-Haq, Jawad's mother, Waad Al-Shafi, said her husband Osama is still in Israeli detention. She said in an affidavit, quote, our son Jawad still suffers from severe pain and scarring on his legs as a result of the torture inflicted on him. Our family has no information so far about my husband Osama, who remains detained. Maha Husseini reported that an Israeli military spokesperson rejected the claims of abuse in a statement sent to Middle East Eye. Quote, the claims that the IDF abused a toddler are completely unfounded and serve Hamas propaganda, the spokesperson said. According to the family, the child has suffered from a high fever, vomiting, and persistent crying since his release. He clings to his mother constantly and refuses to be left alone, Mohammed said. That's from Maha Husseini's report in Middle East Eye. In related news, a report on Israel's rampant and systematic use of torture against Palestinian children, men, and women was presented to the United Nations Human Rights Council on Monday. In her report, Torture and Genocide, UN Special Rapporteur Francesca Albanese named Israel's National Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir, Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich, and Defense Minister Israel Katz as the primary political figures involved in shaping policies that expanded and enabled the torture of Palestinians 2.5 years into the genocide in Gaza. She called on the International Criminal Court to pursue arrest warrants for them. Albanese's report states that, quote, torture has always been a central feature of the dispossession of Palestinians by Israel. Yet since October 2023, Israel has employed torture on a scale that suggests collective vengeance and destructive intent. The escalation of torture in Israeli detention centers is a coordinated plan, she adds, and highlights several ways that Palestinians are tortured and abused. Quote, severe physical violence is routine, the report states. Israeli guards subject detainees to waterboarding, suspending them for prolonged periods by cuffed hands, and subject them to severe beatings, including with batons and other weapons. They burn detainees with cigarettes, force them to kneel on gravel, hold prolonged stress positions, and to take hallucinogenic drugs. Pepper spray, tear gas, electric shocks, and assault dogs are also used. In frequent raids by specialized repression units, Palestinians are forced to bend over while being slapped, beaten, and systematically humiliated. In a press conference held this week to discuss her latest report, Albanese spoke about the broad-spectrum environment of torture that Israel has not only employed against Palestinians, but has carried out with systematic impunity.
The reason why I say we need to address the problem at its roots is that we have this tendency of focusing on the symptoms. I've been part of it. I've been working in the occupied Palestinian territory, and I've been part of that in humanitarian industry, focusing on, oh, let's ask Israel. We need to make sure that Israel respects the rights of the Palestinian children in military courts. No, this is shameful. We need to make sure that Israel stops arresting and detaining Palestinians, especially children, and trying them in military courts. We need to make sure that Israel withdraws its troops, dismantles the colonies, and stop tormenting the Palestinians. This is the thing. So Israel has decimated the health system from the very beginning. This is part of the intention, because apart from those who are killed by bombs and snipers, there are all those who die, and this cannot be counted, surely not today, die because of infections that couldn't be treated because of lack of medications, or because of they had chronic illnesses and could not be cured. And look at the sadism. Israel wants everyone to leave, but they want to leave them to leave en masse in a disorderly fashion, because even those applying for medical evacuation cannot leave. How brutal it is. How brutal. Again, seriously, every question you ask me, I could spend hours to tell you more and more. But what else needs to be seen in order to stop Israel? Why Israel is granted this enormous exception and license to kill, to rape, to torture a population?
Francesca Albanese. Meanwhile, on March 24th, a group of UN experts demanded that Israel immediately release Dr. Hussam Abu Safia, the pediatrician and director of Kamal Adwan Hospital in northern Gaza, who was abducted by Israeli forces in December 2024 and has been in detention inside Israeli torture camps ever since. The UN experts say they had received new reports that he had been subjected to, quote, severe torture. We have received reports that Dr. Abu Safia has been subjected to torture and other cruel and degrading treatment, and that his health condition remains dire, the group said. Going back to Francesca Albanese's UN report on torture, the systematic targeting of specific professional categories, including doctors, quote, demonstrates an intent to dismantle the technical capacities needed for a group's survival. Torture in detention is therefore not merely punitive. It is strategic. It operates to degrade Palestinian bodies, fracture psychological integrity, and erode collective resilience. Even short-term detention produces physical and psychological harm, whose effects radiate beyond the individual, affecting families and entire communities in ways that are enduring and, in many instances, irreparable. Turning to the occupied West Bank, Jewish Israeli settlers continued their violent pogroms against Palestinian towns and villages, while the Israeli government seized more than a dozen Palestinian apartments and gave them to settler groups in the neighborhood of Silwan in East Jerusalem. Over just 4 days this past week, Israeli settlers attacked at least 24 Palestinian villages in the Nablus, Ramallah, Hebron, and Bethlehem governorates, according to the Palestinian Government Media Center. The attacks were carried out in 11 waves, during which at least 23 Palestinians were injured. The assaults also resulted in damage to 17 homes and structures, mainly due to arson and acts of vandalism, in addition to the destruction of 26 vehicles and one car scrapyard. The surge of violent attacks by extremist settlers expanded after an 18-year-old settler drove around threatening residents of the village of Beit Imrin on March 21st and was killed in a reported car accident that was blamed on a Palestinian. Settler WhatsApp groups then called for a, quote, revenge campaign over his death, including calls that read, quote, Jews won't remain silent over spilled Jewish blood, and we demand vengeance and expulsion of the enemy. Settlers rampaged through the village of Al-Jalud near Nablus on March 21st, torching homes and vehicles. In the nearby village of Deir al-Hatab, 9 Palestinians were injured on Sunday, March 22nd, when settlers stormed the village, attacked residents' homes, set several houses and vehicles on fire, and shot at residents. Paramedics treated one man who was shot in the foot, while others were beaten and attacked by the settlers. Later that evening, settlers set fire to property owned by Palestinians in various areas northwest of Nablus, in simultaneous attacks targeting the Masudiya archaeological site and the village of Deir Sharaf, according to a local activist speaking to the Wafa news agency. Diab Hidji, an anti-colonization activist and resident of the archaeological area, told Wafa that around 30 masked settlers attacked the Masudiya archaeological area and set fire to part of a tourist tent before local youth confronted them and forced them to leave the area. In the village of Deir Sharaf, local sources reported that a group of settlers burned part of a car wash west of the town, coinciding with acts of rampage along the road connecting Nablus and Tulkarem. Sources indicated to Wafa that the attacks in Deir Sharaf expanded to include the burning of a blacksmith's office, a crane in front of the car wash, and a bulldozer in the area. Settlers ran over and injured five Palestinians on March 24th, west of Bethlehem in the village of Nahalin, in two separate hit-and-run incidents, according to the Wafa news agency, while more than 200 settlers attacked the towns of Al-Fanda Kumiya and Silat al-Dahr, south of Jenin. The attackers launched their pogrom from the nearby illegal Homesh settlement colony, according to eyewitnesses. Palestinian homes and vehicles were set on fire, and more than 10 residents suffered injuries. Speaking to Middle East Eye, a man whose home was completely destroyed in the fire said that the settlers, quote, burned everything, smashed the windows, and the fire consumed all the furniture. They even tore down the roof tiles and threw Molotov cocktails through the roof and windows, and the house immediately burst into flames. A boys' elementary school was vandalized by Israeli settlers in the village of Hawara on Monday, according to the Wafa news agency. Graffiti was sprayed on the walls of the school with slogans such as revenge and a good Arab is a dead Arab, and settlers replaced the Palestinian flag on the roof with an Israeli flag. In the East Jerusalem neighborhood of Silwan, the Israeli municipality seized 13 apartments belonging to Palestinian families on Wednesday, adding to a total of 15 stolen properties over a period of just 4 days. Israeli police escorted occupiers from Ataret Kohanim, a settler group that facilitates expulsions of Palestinians from Jerusalem, into the Batan al-Hawa area of Silwan, where two families were forced out of their apartments, witnesses told Anadolu news agency. The Wadi Hilwa Information Center in Silwan said in a statement that the operation began with the eviction of the families from two apartments, followed by Israeli enforcement teams emptying 11 apartments belonging to the Rajabi family in preparation for their takeover. The process was ongoing as authorities cleared the apartments to hand them over to settler organizations, citing claims that the land belongs to Jews of Yemeni origin, the statement added. On Sunday, Ataret Kohanim took over two apartments belonging to the Basbous family. The Right Center said the Basbous family building is part of a settlement plan led by Ataret Kohanim to take control of about 5.2 dunams of land in Batan al-Hawa. We've published many features in the last week, but we wanted to highlight What Has Israel Done to My Brother? By Amro Rashad Abu Aisha, writing from Gaza. Just 2 months into the genocide, Abu Aisha writes, he and his family had already been displaced from their Gaza City home several times and ended up staying at his aunt's home in the Rimal neighborhood of the city. On December 6, 2023, when the Israeli army invaded the neighborhood, he still felt some sense of safety. But that sense quickly collapsed, he writes, when an Israeli tank stationed itself right outside of his aunt's apartment building. He and his family moved into the stairwell of the building and hid there for 36 hours, trying to evade the army's detection. But the tank eventually fired on the building. Quote, the next day, around 6 p.m., soldiers stormed the building next door. We could hear them speaking Hebrew, but the 60 or so residents of our building remained quiet. Then, without any warning, our neighbor's baby started to cry. The soldiers in the next building heard the wailing, and we could hear them making their way towards us. One soldier appeared and screamed at us in a broken Arabic accent, Yalla kullu bara, come on, everyone outside. I was not panicking at this time, as I had heard that the army would let people free when they found them in fighting areas, but this was not how it went for us. Everyone in the building was forced onto the street. I was surprised by the number of soldiers there. There were about 50 of them, about the same number as us. And in addition to that, two tanks were stationed nearby with their artillery pointed at us. The soldiers separated the women and children from men. My mom and two youngest brothers, aged 13 and 7, were told to walk south in a line. Yet my brother Asim, who is only 16, was forced to come with the men, along with my brothers Adel, 27, Abdullah, 25, Yusuf, 24, and myself. The soldiers led us to Palestine Square, about 70 meters from the building. They ordered us to raise our hands, to not look around, and to stay in line. At the square, the soldiers ordered all of us to remove our clothing. It was very cold outside, and we did so. They commanded us to sit on the ground, raise our hands up, and keep our heads down. After 30 minutes, they took us to the entrance of a nearby building that the soldiers had seemingly set up as a kind of impromptu headquarters. They tied our hands behind our backs tightly, blindfolded our eyes, and kept us standing for 2 hours. I remember my brother Yusuf fell to the ground, though I did not see this. I could only recognize his scream. Also, my father, who is in his 50s, was suffering because the plastic handcuffs were so tight. Afterwards, he told me that his hands went numb, that it was like his hands had been cut off. After 2 hours of standing and with the blindfold on, I felt like I was in a daze. My body felt unstable, and I wished that this was actually a dream and not actually happening. At this time, the soldier who had identified himself as the battalion commander delivered a speech. We all stood before him, naked and blindfolded. "Now I will start an investigation, and I need the truth only," he said. Some of our blindfolds were removed, and he pulled out his phone and showed us a picture of a dog eating a corpse. He scrolled through many images on his phone like this. "This is what will happen to anybody who lies to me," he said. At 10 p.m., the commander came and took my father, brothers, and me to the ground floor of the building. They put us in the building's housekeeper's room. They beat us, one after the other, punching, slapping, and kicking. They put the barrel of a gun to my head. I remained quiet this whole time, as I did not feel afraid of death at this moment. They smoked cigarettes and put the burning ends on my ear and my back. At dawn, two soldiers got us up on our feet. It seemed that the commander had given an order to release us. They removed the blindfolds. A soldier told us to follow him. We walked about 500 meters to the last of the tanks and to our families. With the blindfolds removed, I saw that they had not released my brothers, nor another man named Nafith Ahmed. The next day, my father and I went to Al-Shifa Hospital to ask about my brothers. There was no word of them. Then, the day after that, two of my brothers, Yusuf and Abdullah, appeared at the school. Adil was not with them. They told us that they had been used as human shields. The soldiers had forced them to perform dangerous tasks. They went down into tunnels and into other dangerous places, all before the soldiers themselves. The soldiers threatened that if anyone refused to do this, then their brother would be shot and killed. We asked them about Adil, and Abdullah replied, "We performed many operations, but during the last one, Adil went out and never came back." I asked one soldier about him, and he replied that they released him. Day after day, we have waited for Adil's return. 15 days later, near the end of December 2023, the Israeli troops withdrew from the area, but only after they had completely destroyed everything in their wake. It was a massive destruction, unlike any I had seen before, much more so than the 2008-9 Israeli war on Gaza, when our house in the Nasser neighborhood was bombed and destroyed by Israel. There were human bodies, many of them decomposing, in the streets. I checked all of them to see if anyone was alive. I was also looking for Adil, but I did not find him. After the Israeli withdrawal, we contacted the International Committee for the Red Cross to see how we could find out what happened to Adil. When we reached out to the Red Cross, the answer is always the same. There is no information. Those are excerpts from What Has Israel Done to My Brother by Amro Rashad Abu Aisha, an English student, writing from Gaza on electronicintifada.net. And now, as we always do, we wanted to highlight people expressing joy, determination, and reclamation across Palestine and around the world. In Gaza, reporter Salma Kadoumi visited bakeries making sweets for the Eid holiday. She writes, quote, "As the holiday approaches, the production of Turkish delight returns to the forefront in Gaza despite difficult conditions. Artisans strive to revive this traditional craft and bring joy to people's hearts. Despite shortages of raw materials and rising costs, workers continue producing Turkish delight as part of a holiday tradition that never fades. They emphasize their resilience and commitment to preserving cultural heritage, making the sweet a symbol of joy and hope in the face of hardship." And that's it for the news roundup. As always, go to electronicintifada.net for much more, especially to read our new features by our brave writers in Gaza. You've been listening to the Electronic Intifada's newscast. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. Want to hear more? Check out our live stream with interviews, reports, and analysis, along with print articles, podcasts, and more at electronicintifada.net. Produced by Nora Barrows-Friedman, Tamara Nassar, and Pierre Loisel.